This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkel, the constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. Coming up on this week's show, we'll take a look at a new study that looks at the marital happiness of kids that attend Christian schools. Also, we'll be joined by Ambassador Sam Brownback to talk about his new role on the world stage. But first, to call the Higher Education Reauthorization Act of 1965 groundbreaking would only tell part of the story. In December, Republicans on the House Committee on Education and the Workforce introduced the Promoting Real Opportunity, Success, and Prosperity Through Education Reform Act. The first real step from this Congress in reauthorizing the Higher Education Act of 1965. Joining Tony to talk about the so-called Prosper Act is Congressman Tim Walberg. He represents the 7th Congressional District of Michigan and serves on the House Committee on Education and the Workforce. Here now is Tony Perkins.
Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's good to be with you. Thanks for the good work you do.
Well, thank you. And this bill that you're working on, along with Congresswoman Virginia Fox, is groundbreaking in that this addresses a lot of how, in my view, as I've read through the bill, and it's a pretty lengthy bill, 590 pages, the left has hijacked higher education, and this is bringing it back to really the students and their families and what their parents are paying for when they send them off to college.
And the principles of freedom. Tony, I suppose if you and I could talk, we would both agree that the federal government really shouldn't have a place in education. I read my Constitution. I don't see any inferences or spots or articles or sections in our U.S. Constitution that gives the federal government any responsibility for education. That takes place in the states, in the local communities. And I don't see the Northwest Ordinance phrase that said religion, morality, knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. That's in the Michigan Constitution, and I know several other state constitutions, but not the federal government. But having said all of that, we know that we deal with what's real right now and try to, at the very least, devolve the control of the federal government on education, higher education in this case, as best as possible and keep moving in the right direction. And the Prosper Act does that. Taking aim at what's been going on in the education establishment of controlling the hearts, minds, and understanding of our people and the politics, ultimately, in our civilization.
Right, because what happens on those college campuses eventually finds its way into the halls of government.
Absolutely, and we're seeing training grounds for a small liberal mindset that comes in doesn't understand what true education is about, that lifts society, that motivates people to think toward truth, and understanding that truth is non-negotiable. It is or it isn't. And what we've seen today is educationists that are trying to blockade off the free exchange of ideas and control what goes on, not only in the minds of their students, but also institutions, and taking institutions like Hillsdale College in my district or Wheaton College, one of my alma maters, and saying to them, you cannot stand for your distinctives and expect to be accredited. We're going to hold your feet to the fire until you acquiesce to what we want you to speak for.
Well, Congressman Walberg, what we saw in the last administration is that the mechanisms of higher ed that are controlled by the federal government were weaponized to try to make, as you pointed out just a moment ago, religious institutions to conform to a liberal mindset. And they do that a couple of ways. One, they do it through student loans, disqualifying them from student loans by erasing or eradicating their accreditation. So what this bill does is that it actually says, look, college campuses should be a bastion of free speech and the free exchange of ideas. Right. You're not forcing a conservative viewpoint. What you're saying is all viewpoints should be allowed right on a college campus.
All treated equally. The Sierra Club, if they have a club on campus, ought to be able to have their own people involved with it, have the basic tenets that require their leadership to espouse Sierra Club philosophy. And then I think those that are related InterVarsity, Christian Fellowship, ought to be able to invite anyone and everyone into their meetings, but still have the ability to say there are principles that we expect our leadership to follow. And if you can't, then you can't be a leader. So those are some of the principles we reaffirm in our Prosper Act, as well as when you're talking about loans, grants, scholarships, et cetera, work-study programs. We're expanding higher education and its use of that to say it's not only for our four-year college and university institutions, but it can be for trade schools, apprenticeship programs, paid internship programs that allow our students to be educated beyond the high school into some type of certification, associate's degree, or bachelor's, graduate degrees that lead toward a solid understanding that promotes a job that they can carry on in society.
What, Congressman, bothers me so much, because I've actually seen it applied to conservatives. In fact, its use has grown in its frequency, and that is these free speech zones to either restrict the speech of students or those coming onto the campus. And as I understand this bill, what it lays out is it says, look, you can establish free speech guidelines. Obviously, we want order on our college campuses. But what they can't do under the provisions of this bill is change the standards, the rules of the game, just because they want to eliminate a speaker or a particular subject.
Right. Absolutely true. Again, we're going to give you all the same opportunity. And if we have a free speech zone for one speaker, it's going to be the same for every other speaker that comes on campus. And you're right, Tony. We want to make sure that we don't have campus speech that causes such foment that we go into riots that we've seen at times, even most recently at Berkeley. But we need to make sure that those Berkeley students or those individuals that are paid in some cases to come on campus and disrupt understand that, no, everyone will be treated equally, and free speech is truly that here, as long as it remains orderly.
Well, Congressman Wahlberg, that brings up a question. This bill treats everyone the same in terms of the free speech, equality of speech, if you will. Everybody can say their viewpoint, as long as in the confines of the law. Why then is there opposition to that concept? Why is it that liberals do not want free speech and conservatives are fine with free speech, freedom of association, even if it's contrary to their principles and viewpoint?
Right. I think it indicates that liberals aren't liberal with their willingness to extend the same freedoms and opportunities to people who disagree with them as they would to people who agree with them. It's a change agentry that's going on, and we've seen it for too long, and I think that's why we're concerned about higher education. It's become a bastion for change agentry in moving us away from the solid principles that began with the Reformation, were carried out in the documentation that established our great country, all the freedoms with responsibility that we have here, and all of the success that came from it. They still believe that anything other than free enterprise capitalism truly a Christian environment that gave opportunity for all people is something that we have to end and take it to a socialist point of view. That is why we cannot allow our higher education institutions to continue to capture our young minds and reshape them against what makes this country great, as opposed to saying we want to fill your minds with all sorts of thoughts freely given and freely considered, and then from that, build upon it your education that makes a difference for you and others in years to come with the freedom and opportunity.
If you want to find out more about Representative Tim Wahlberg, head over to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Also, I want to invite you to be a part of keeping Washington Watch on the air by going to TonyPerkins.com and making a tax-deductible contribution. Again, that's TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at marriage and Christian education.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? Pornography fuels the sex trafficking industry. Each click of pornography creates a demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. Victims of sex trafficking are often coerced into having abortions. To learn more about how you can help stop this triple threat, go to frc.org/traffic.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. According to a new study, Gen X and millennial-aged adults who attended evangelical Protestant schools are more likely to get married and have children than their peers who attended public schools. Research conducted by the Canada-based think tank Cartis also found among young adults aged 24 to 39, evangelical Protestant schoolers are less likely to cohabit. Joining Tony to talk about the study is Dr. Beth Green, Education Program Director of Cartis.
Dr. Green, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much.
I found this very fascinating because it has significant ramifications for public policy and the health of society. But before I venture into that, I want to talk about this particular study. What prompted this research?
So this is part of a very big national survey that we commission in both the US and Canada every 2 years. We commission the study because we think that the school sector that you attend matters, not just for learning outcomes, so academic outcomes, but also because it affects the kind of person that you will become when you leave school. So that's your civic engagement, your moral formation, spiritual and religious outcomes. And we're particularly interested in how school interacts with faith formation. So it's very typical to say that school sector doesn't have much of an effect, that religious faith, spirituality, all of that's explained by the faith of your parents, your family, the community you grew up with. And of course, those things are very important. But we had a hunch that what you learn in school might be relevant too. And our research shows that graduates from graduates from Protestant evangelical schools and independent Catholic schools in the U.S. have very distinct profiles in some of the areas that you mentioned. So in terms of the choices they make about family life, getting married, parenting, having children, but also in terms of their profile as well-rounded, healthy, flourishing citizens.
Now, in this study, this was a sample of about 2,000 private school attendees. The report focused on 245 U.S. students and 203 Canadian students who went to Protestant schools. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. So what we released last week was kind of a smaller dig down deep into the data because we wanted to examine the pathways that students follow after they graduate high school because we follow up with them when they're young adults, when they're kind of making those sorts of choices about setting up home, family life, starting work, or maybe going on to further education. So the report that we released examines how those sorts of decisions, like where you go to college and university, the age you are when you get married, the number of children you have, how those choices reinforce and interact with the very clear school sector effect that we're seeing when you attend an evangelical Christian school. And we're seeing that it does really make a difference and it does matter.
So this is a longitudinal study. You're looking at this long term?
That's right. We follow up with. It's not longitudinal in that we're not following the same people every time, but we refresh the sample every 2 years because we're trying to map social changes, and we're seeing that in the general population, fewer people appear to be walking some of these pathways of attending Christian schools, making different choices about marriage, cohabitation, and so we're trying to track that, and we have found that if you go to a Protestant evangelical school, you're 60% more likely to be married than a public school graduate. It's making some difference in terms of how people are making choices about their lives and about raising their families.
Now, Dr. Green, you also point out in this study that there is a slight difference between students in the U.S. that go to these evangelical Protestant schools and Canadian students
That's right. Go
to these. What's the difference?
So I think it's probably to do with how the sectors function in both America and in Canada. So some of the histories around why people started schools and set them up is different. And in Canada, of course, we have got some Christian schools which are actually publicly funded, which is something that doesn't happen in the US. I also have a hunch that it may be to do with some of the changes in increasing secularization that we're seeing in Canada. So Canada's in quite a different space to the US, although the evidence is that some of these things are happening in the US context too. So that might explain those differences.
Did you look at curriculum that's taught in these schools? Did you
So not in this study. This is a big data set that looks at school sector. So we haven't drilled down into individual schools and patterns of kind of teaching and learning what's actually taught in a school. The good news is that we've got new research that we're commissioning where we will be looking at that, firstly for Canada, and then we hope to do the same in the US, because we're interested in what explains these kinds of differences. You're right, it's going to be about teaching and learning. It's also going to be about the structure of the school, the kinds of people that you interact with, and the relationship between your school and church and home.
If you want to find out more about Dr. Green or the study, just head on over to tonyperkins.com and follow the links. Also, a quick reminder that your generous contributions to Family Research Council enable us to continue making these programs available. And you can donate when you visit tonyperkins.com. We'll be back with Ambassador Sam Brownback right after this.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. This is because transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. Yet even the federal government has stated that there is no evidence that gender reassignment surgery has improved health outcomes. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Former Kansas Governor Sam Brownback was officially sworn in on January 31st as U.S. Ambassador-at-Large for International Religious Freedom. Ambassador Brownback is a strong proponent for religious liberty and joined FRC President Tony Perkins on Wednesday.
Ambassador Brownback, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks, Tony. Really appreciate you. Appreciate the program that you guys put on and all that you guys stand for. Keep fighting. Keep fighting strong.
Well, I know you're excited about the new opportunity. I know the challenges could not be greater. When you look across the landscape globally, what is your assessment of religious freedom?
It's under attack. It's perhaps never been worse than it is now for as far as the level of religious persecution that's taking place. It takes place in many ways and forms, from people being beheaded because they're Christians, to people being denied their medical services or being ousted from countries because they're not Buddhist in some places. It's unfortunately, the state of religious freedom is on the decline. But I have to say, too, I think this administration, the Trump administration, really needs to stop that decline and reverse it and see religious freedom expand and to use the tools available for the United States government to push religious freedom around the world for all people of all types of faith.
And I think evidence of that commitment is the selection, the nomination, and the push to confirm you as ambassador-at-large for that post. This is something that's been a priority, at least in the stated law, the statutes, going back to the late 90s. Former Congressman Frank Wolf of Virginia kind of championing that issue. And we've seen in the last administration the neglect, the void of leadership on this issue. And, of course, what it's led to is an increase of the influence of the tyrants. As you, you're just getting your feet on the ground, I can only imagine what the first week has been like. What will be your initial focus as you begin to try to wrap your head around the global nature of this problem?
There's a lot to do, but you know, initially, Tony, what I'm looking at is northern Iraq and Syria because of the religious cleansing that has taken place there of Yazidis and Christians, and then Burma, of what's taking place there, of the Muslim minority being pushed out into Bangladesh. There's no shortage of issues, unfortunately. There's others taking place in many other places around the world. Nigeria, unfortunately, situations in China and India. I could just really rattle off quite a few, but those two that I mentioned are the ones that I'm looking at initially being the ones I want to focus on the most to really try to move the agenda forward and help these persecuted religious minorities.
Of course, the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which the UN adopted, which was pushed by Eleanor Roosevelt, who actually helped really push that through the UN, makes very clear that religious freedom is the right to choose your religion or change your religion, which is the definition that the United States has used. And many countries have signed on to that. But there's been no one who has really held it up as the standard of what religious liberty is. This comes back to our State Department, and I'm hoping that so under your influence, we'll see the State Department putting a higher priority once again on religious freedom as something that America wants to export.
I agree, Tony. You know, I helped carry that 28 bill when we first put this into law and created the Office of the Ambassador-at-Large for International Religious Freedom, and it was because we weren't getting any support, not in my estimation, or very little, out of the State Department. They just really didn't want to deal with religion. They kind of saw it as a complicating factor and not something that helps good foreign policy. We got plenty of other things to do. A number of us in the Congress were going, no, this is a foundational issue, and you've got to get this human right first. This is the first human right, what you do with your own soul. And if you get this one right, the others will follow from it. A, B, now we've got the studies that show you'll have better security and less terrorism. If you let people practice their faith the way they see fit to do, they're not going to fight you. They're going to use the lawful means at their disposal, and the amount of terrorism goes down and the amount of security goes up for a nation if people are free to practice their faith.
Yeah, what's fascinating about that, Ambassador, is not only is the issue of security there, but also economic development and growth. Those countries that have the strongest laws protecting religious freedom also have the strongest laws protecting free market principles, which lead to economic growth.
They do. They go hand in hand. But the thing that I'm really excited about in this, Tony, is I really think we've got a moment now where things can start to move. We've got the studies now that show this leads to greater security. We know about it on economic fronts, but it's also that there's a globalization, I think, that's being realized that I think a lot of people thought that religion was going to fade as a matter of interest around the world, that reason was going to take over. But the opposite has happened. We've had people's faith grow around the world. And to be able to then accommodate that in a growing nation and a diverse area, you need to allow this religious freedom. So it seems like the moment is right for this decline to stop and an increase to move forward, and it's part of why I'm excited about getting into this role.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you here with us on this Wednesday afternoon. Ambassador Sam Brownback is my guest. He is Ambassador-at-Large for Religious Freedom, just newly sworn into that post last Thursday. You know, Ambassador, a lot of folks... not a lot of folks. There are some critics among the, I'm going to say the evangelical world that say that, and even the media, that President Trump is simply giving lip service to religious freedom. I push back on that because I see a real commitment to this. And, I mean, again, his selecting you for this post would suggest to me that he's serious about dealing with this issue and not just looking for window dressing or for some type of religious parade with no substance.
I agree with that. You know, I mean, I am who I am, Tony. I've got a long track record of public service. I'm a social conservative. I'm a well-known person of faith. I may fight to get through the Senate. And indeed, the vice president had to vote twice to get me through the Senate on tie votes. Well, that's not something you're just going to do for window dressing. You're doing that because, look, I think this is the guy that can do the job and he's going to push hard, and I'm willing to push hard to get him there. And that was there. The office has been well-staffed. the vice president swore me in. The vice president is personally vested in this. He's the one that called me, really recruited me into the job. This administration is vested in this, and I think now what you're going to see is them willing to use the teeth that are in the laws to be able to push religious freedom like it's never been pushed before. And that's going to be, you know, partially up to me, too, and to some of your listeners to push the administration and the public officials to say religious freedom is central. I want to see the administration do this.
And that's what I want to ask you next, Ambassador, is how can our listeners and the churches, the pastors across this country, help raise the profile of this issue? Because I believe that as Christians, we have an obligation to be concerned about our neighbors, whether they're one block away or one continent away. We still have an obligation to speak up for them.
You know, I think what a lot of the pastors and people can do is just put out some of the stories. I met today with a Syrian Orthodox community that's in northern Iraq and have been driven out of there, and a number of their people have been trafficked. Putting those stories out or putting them up on a video site. I met yesterday with an Yazidi woman who had been trafficked and her family members killed in the Nineveh Plains. They're going to have a documentary. There is a documentary out now on her showing that documentary. So that people can see these are real people, real lives, that represent hundreds of thousands of people that have been persecuted simply because they were not the dominant faith
right,
in their area.
Right.
And that, I think those can be helpful.
I think I know who you're talking about. I hosted her at Council for National Policy meeting, because I do think that oftentimes we get tunnel vision, only see what's happening here. And we do have, as a leader, as a nation that is in a leadership role, we have an obligation to lead out on these, what you say, fundamental freedoms, because without religious freedom, there can be no true freedom. Ambassador, I want to thank you for joining us. We look forward to locking arms with you to take this message across this country and literally around the globe.
God bless you and appreciate your prayers.
You can find more about Ambassador Brownback when you visit tonyperkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. And if you find the weekend edition of Washington Watch informative and useful, we'd encourage you to tell your friends about Washington Watch. You can help us reach more people with this radio ministry by supporting our efforts and heading over to tonyperkins.com and clicking on the donate button. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.